difficulty will provide just the right amount of spice and keep the game interesting. If we can find it, we'll get twice as much benefit for our time, and we'll have much more fun in the process. Key points. 1. Memory tests are most effective when they're challenging. The closer you get to forgetting a word, the more ingrained it will become when you finally remember it. 2. If you can consistently test yourself right before you forget, you'll double the effectiveness of every test. Principle 5. Rewrite the past. The difference between false memories and true ones is the same as for jewels. It is always the false ones that look the most real, the most brilliant. Salvador Dali. I remember waking up one day with a symphony in my head. I had dreamt that I was sitting at my desk, composing, and I woke up with the results intact. Beaming with pride, I ran to my brother. "Listen to this," I said, and I began humming a few bars. "Isn't that awesome? I composed it in my sleep." "No, you didn't," my brother replied. "It's from the Superman movie. We saw it last week." As we discussed earlier, a memory is just a web of connections. Disparate neurons fire together, wire together, and become more likely to fire together in the future. In my dream, I remembered the Superman theme at the same time as I envisioned myself composing. My brain reflexively connected the two into a convincing new memory, a false memory, and I went and embarrassed myself in front of my brother. This happens to all of us, and it's a result of the way we store memories. In a 2011 memory study, researchers showed two groups of college students a vivid, image-related advertisement for a new fake brand of popcorn, Orville Redenbacher's Gourmet Fresh. Afterward, they thanked the first group and sent them home. Then they gave the second group samples of fresh popcorn. 1 week later, they brought both groups back and asked them about their impressions. Now here's where it gets creepy. Both groups vividly remembered trying the popcorn, even though one group never had. They all thought it was delicious. When we remember, we don't just access our memories. We rewrite them. Prompted by the popcorn advertisement, these college students remembered movie nights at home, the smell of corn and butter, the crunch in their mouths and the salt on their lips. In the midst of reliving these experiences, they saw images of other people enjoying popcorn in bags marked Orville Redenbacher's Gourmet Fresh. And their memories changed. The network of neurons from past movie nights activated at the same time as they saw the brand's logo. Because neurons that fire together wire together, their brain stored those new connections as if they had always been there. Our single memories are amalgamations of every recall experience we've ever had. When I remind you of the word gatto, you probably recall a little image of a cat. But as that image floats around in your head, you can't store it just as it was. You're a different person now, with different information in your head and at a different part in this book. Perhaps you've also changed rooms, or your emotional state, or perhaps you now have a cat in your lap. You have a wholly new set of neurons involved in this gatto experience, compared with your last one. As a result, your new gatto memory will join the new connections from your present to the old reactivated connections from your past. In that single act of recall, your gatto network has doubled in size. This rewriting process is the engine behind long-term memorization. Every act of recall imbues old memories with a trace of your present-day self. This trace gives those memories additional connections, new images, emotions, sounds, and word associations that make your old memory easier to recall. Once you've rewritten these memories enough times, they become unforgettable. Feedback to the rescue. Of course, you must remember a memory before you can rewrite it. You will remember American Express, Don't Leave Home Without It, to your dying day, because American Express has spent millions of dollars making its ads memorable. Every time you see a new American Express ad, the vivid images and sounds are rewritten into your memory of their all-important slogan. You would forget their slogan between each commercial cycle if they eliminated the famous actors and the imagery-laden travel scenarios from their ads. If this happened, the crucial rewriting process would never occur. Don't Leave Home Without It will become just another forgotten advertisement rather than one of the most successful ad campaigns in history. In practicing recall, we are striving to continuously rewrite our memories. We create a memory for Gato, and we build upon that memory with every recall until it is as unforgettable as an ad slogan. But what happens when we can't remember? Surely we won't be able to remember everything we learn, particularly if we're trying to wait as long as possible between practice sessions. The day may come when we try to remember Gato and draw blank instead. We've forgotten the word. And in this scenario, it will stay forgotten. Like Ebbinghaus's gobbledygook, we'll be able to learn it faster in the future, but we won't get any benefit from our practice. We need a way to restore our forgotten memories, and we'll find it in immediate feedback. Feedback is a simple concept with dramatic results. If we encounter our Gato flashcard and get stumped, then we can simply look at the back side of the card and see a picture of a cat. We have just given ourselves immediate feedback, and as a result, one of two things happened. If our memory of Gato has vanished, then we start over. We form a new, original experience at the moment we got stumped and looked at the answer. This is not as good as remembering our actual original experience, but it's still very effective. Our brains are primed and ready to create a new memory. As we search our memories for Gato-related images and associations, we build a wide network of neural connections. We may remember that Gato is a type of animal, but we can't remember which one. If we encounter an image of a cat while these connections are still active, our completed network will burst into activity. The reward centers of our brains will activate, and we'll have a new, deep, and memorable experience to build upon. Alternatively, we may still have access to our original memory of Gato. This memory will burst into life. Oh, yeah! At the moment we see that picture of a cat. In this scenario, we'll relive our memory. Our new experience will join it, and the memory will be rewritten with new connections. Thanks to a simple act of immediate feedback, we've regained our rewrite. Feedback allows us to resuscitate forgotten memories and get the most out of our practice sessions. Key points. 1. Every time you successfully recall a memory, you revisit and rewrite earlier experiences, adding bits and pieces of your present self to your past memories. 2. You'll make the best use of your time when practicing recall if your earlier experiences are as memorable as possible. You can accomplish this by connecting sounds, images, and personal connections to every word you learn. 3. When you do forget, use immediate feedback to bring back your forgotten memories. Timing is everything. The end of forgetting. Observe due measure, for right timing is in all things the most important factor. Hesiod. How do we combine the five principles? We want our original memories to be as deep and multisensory as possible. 1. Make memories more memorable. We want to study as little as possible. 2. Maximize laziness. And practice recall as much as possible. 3. Don't review, recall. We want our recall practice to be challenging, but not too hard. 4. Wait, don't tell me. And last, when we practice, we want to nearly forget those original experiences, but not forget them completely. And when we do forget, we want immediate feedback to put us back on track. 5. Rewrite the past. If we could predict exactly how long we could remember each thing we learn, we would be able to work miracles with our minds. We would have an alarm that went off right before we forgot where we left our car keys, and life would be a wonderful paradise free of forgetting. Unfortunately, our memories are too messy. They make unpredictable connections to everything we experience or imagine. They lose pieces of our past and gain pieces of our present. Any mention of a car, a lock, or even a word that rhymes with key can enhance or suppress our key-related memories. I can't count the number of times I've memorized some word, only to have some new, similar-sounding word come along and screw everything up months later. We can't accurately predict when we will forget a single memory. However, we can make predictions about a group of memories. Take a gaggle of college students and teach them obscure trivia, like who invented snow golf, and then let them practice recall once and test them 6 months later. Depending upon the timing of that single practice session, you'll see quite different results on that final test. If they practice immediately, they'll only remember around 25%. A day later, 35%. A week later, 50%. 4 weeks later, 55%. 12 weeks later, down to 45%, and 24 weeks later, around 48%. For students trying to remember something for 6 months, the immediate practice session, that 25% score, is not bad at all. But as the delay increases to 28 days, the students' scores double. This pattern appears in numerous studies, although the ideal delay changes depending upon the final test date. There's a complex balance between the advantages of nearly forgetting and the disadvantages of actually forgetting, and it breaks our forgetting curve in half. If Ebbinghaus did one practice session after 4 weeks, his recall rate after 10 years would jump from just above 10% to just under 50%. That single practice session can make the difference between forgetting nearly everything and remembering quite a bit. Now here's the final leap. If immediate recall practice is good, and delayed practice is better, and if one session is good and many sessions are better, what happens if you delay your recall practice many times? That is the end of forgetting. You learn a word today, and you shelve it for a while. When it comes back, you'll try to recall it, and then shelve it again, on and on, until you couldn't possibly forget. While you're waiting for your old words to return, you can learn new words and send them off into the future, where you'll meet them again and work them into your long-term memory. At least until you can upload jujitsu directly into your brain, this is the most efficient way to memorize large amounts of information permanently. In search of the perfect interval. You want to remember as much as possible now, later, and much later. To choose how often to practice, you have to balance efficiency and comfort. In general, you're not studying for a single test with a specific date, so you can't pick an optimal interval and run with it. For the extreme long term, you'll get the best efficiency if you wait years between practice sessions, but that won't help you in the short term at all. Moreover, your practice sessions would be extremely frustrating. After such a long delay, you'd have forgotten almost everything. On the other hand, if you practiced all the time, you'd be able to remember almost everything, but your old words would come back so often that they would bury you in hours of daily work. The thread between these two goals, remembering now and remembering later, starts small and grows rapidly. You'll begin with short intervals, from 2 to 4 days, between practice sessions. Every time you successfully remember, you'll increase that interval, e.g. 9 days, 3 weeks, 2 months, 6 months, etc., quickly reaching intervals of years. This keeps your sessions challenging enough to continuously drive facts into your long-term memory. If you forget a word, you'll start again with short intervals and work your way back to long ones until that word sticks too. This pattern keeps you working on your weakest memories while maintaining and deepening your strongest memories. Because well-remembered words eventually disappear into the far-off future, regular practice creates an equilibrium between old and new. You'll spend a fixed amount of time every day learning new words, remembering words from last week, and occasionally meeting old friends from months or years back. By doing this, you'll spend most of your time successfully recalling words you've almost forgotten and building foundations for new words at a rapid, steady clip. Playing with timing in this way is known as spaced repetition, and it's extraordinarily efficient. In a 4-month period practicing for 30 minutes a day, you can expect to learn and retain 3,600 flashcards with 90 to 95% accuracy. These flashcards can teach you an alphabet, vocabulary, grammar, and even pronunciation. And they can do it without becoming tedious, because they're always challenging enough to remain interesting and fun. Spaced repetition is a godsend to memory-intensive tasks like language learning. It's a pity that it wasn't a subject back in school, when I had a lot more to remember. At its most basic level, a spaced repetition system, or SRS, is a to-do list that changes according to your performance. If you can remember that pollo means chicken after a 2-month delay, then your SRS will automatically wait 4 to 6 months before putting pollo back on your to-do list. If you're having trouble remembering that ropa means clothing for more than 2 weeks, your SRS will put ropa on your list more frequently until it sticks for good. What does this look like in practice? Well, SRSs come in 2 main flavors, on paper or on computer. The computerized versions will perform all of the scheduling on their own. Every time you access your computerized SRS, it will automatically teach you 20 to 30 new cards and quiz you on the 100 or so cards you're about to forget. Your job is to tell your SRS whether or not you remember a particular card, and your SRS's job is to build a daily customized to-do list based upon that input. This list is designed to help you memorize as efficiently as possible, so that you can spend your time learning instead of micromanaging. A paper SRS accomplishes the same feat using a flashcard file box, a carefully designed schedule, and a few simple instructions. It's basically a simple board game. The game contains 7 levels, which correspond to 7 labeled sections in your file box, i.e. level 1, level 2, etc. Every card starts on level 1 and advances to the next level whenever you remember it. If you forget, the card falls all the way back down to level 1. Whenever a card gets past level 7, it has won its place into your long-term memory. Every time you play with your paper SRS, you'll consult your schedule and review the levels of the day, e.g. December 9th, review levels 4, 2, and 1. This is your daily to-do list, and it adapts to your performance because of the way your cards gain and lose levels. By following the rules of the game, which we'll discuss in Appendix 3, you create a primitive paper computer program. This program is just as effective and fun as a computerized SRS, and is satisfying in an I-did-this-by-myself sort of way. At the end of this chapter, we'll compare paper and computerized SRSs in depth, so you don't have to make up your mind just yet. Do-it-yourself deck building. This is not Rosetta Stone. You can't just download a deck of flashcards for your SRS and magically learn a language. So why not? Flashcards are fantastic at reminding you about your original experiences, but they're not particularly good at creating memories in the first place. If you read someone else's Gato flashcard, you probably won't spontaneously think of your childhood cat, or of the numerous Shrek, Puss in Boots, Gato con Botas images that show up on a Google Images search for the word. There's no movie, no sound, and no story. Under these circumstances, you'll be hard-pressed to form a deep, multisensory memory while you're busily studying on the way to work. This isn't the SRS's fault. It's in the nature of the language game. One of the reasons why language programs and classes fail is that no one can give you a language. You have to take it for yourself. You're rewiring your own brain. To succeed, you need to actively participate. Each word in your language needs to become your word. Each grammar rule, your grammar rule. Programs like Rosetta Stone can provide decent original experiences for words like ball and elephant. But eventually, you need to deal with words like economic situation. Abstract words like these require complex personal connections if you're ever going to use them comfortably while speaking. You have to make those connections for yourself, because no one else can tell you how the current situación económica has affected you. You also need to retain the connections you've made, even when you're busy learning new words. This is a lot to do at once, so you may as well use the best tools for the job. Until someone puts a USB port into the back of our skulls, our most effective weapon against forgetting is spaced repetition. And since we need deep, memorable experiences to get the most out of spaced repetition, we might as well get them in the process of making our flashcards. The card construction process is one of the most fun and satisfying ways to learn a language. Content in the knowledge that every detail will become a permanent memory, you become the architect of your own mind. What breed of dog will you think of when you wish to remember the word dog? Which examples will you choose to form your verb conjugations? What vocabulary is most useful for your own life? Making these decisions forms an exciting part of the learning process, and ultimately takes very little time. After getting used to your SRS, you can add new cards in a matter of seconds. For most nouns, you can simply type the word once, search for a picture on Google Images, and copy or draw it on your card. This can take less than 15 seconds. Imagery for more complicated ideas will, of course, take more time to identify, a process that itself gives you the connections you need to make a word your own. I sincerely wish I could sell my personal flashcard decks. If their usefulness were transferable, I'd make a lot of money and I'd help a lot of people. Instead, I give them away for free on my website, with the disclaimer that no one has successfully used them to learn a language. Of the few thousand people who have downloaded them, no one has tried to refute that claim, and so I feel confident stating here that my personal decks are useless to anyone but myself. Use them at your own peril. Frustration and the fate of your smartphone. For a moment, let's consider what happens when someone, not you of course, tries to use one of my flashcard decks. At some point, he'll run into my card for dog and see a golden retriever puppy. Now, I've had the fleeting 15-second experience of searching for this image on the internet, seeing many different dogs of many different ages and breeds, and choosing this golden retriever. In those few seconds of searching, I learned what this word means and chose a pleasant reminder for that learning experience. However, anyone else will have to answer a number of questions and have nothing to base their answers upon. Does this word refer to the breed of dog, its age, its color? In using a non-personalized deck, this instant of confusion will be recorded along with the memory, and the meaning of the word will be uncertain. On its own, uncertainty is not a terrible thing. A great deal of uncertainty is often involved in learning a language in a foreign country. The problem with uncertainty in your flashcards is that it makes your daily reviews more difficult, which translates to added time and added forgetting, which also adds time. The original experience that you'll remember with every review will become, "What does this mean? I don't have time for this shit," which can quickly become frustrating. This last point is the deadly one. As soon as your daily reviews become frustrating, it gets harder and harder to sit down and do them. You may be able to force yourself to stick with it for a few weeks, but you need longer than that to see major results. This becomes a vicious cycle, because frustration impedes your ability to remember, which puts the frustrating cards in front of you more often, which eventually causes you to throw your smartphone out the nearest window. All of this is unnecessary. The learning process for a new word takes very little time, and it's time well spent. If you take just a moment to figure out how to remind yourself of the meaning of a word, you can retain that word forever. This point was nicely summed up by Damien Elms, the creator of my favorite SRS program, Unki. Creating your own deck is the most effective way to learn a complex subject. Subjects like languages and the sciences can't be understood simply by memorizing facts. They require explanation and context to learn effectively. Furthermore, inputting the information yourself forces you to decide what the key points are and leads to a better understanding. Now, I'd add that the card creation process is a lot of fun, too. You get to spend time by yourself and for yourself, learning, discovering, and creating. Once you've done this, your daily reviews become enjoyable, because most of your time is spent saying to yourself, "Holy shit, I can't believe I still remember that. I'm a rock star." It's a daily self-esteem booster that happens to teach you a language at the same time, and it's an easy habit to form and maintain. We like habits. They make the difference between comfortably chatting with the Parisian waitress and awkwardly asking for the English menu. Key point. Spaced repetition systems, or SRSs, are flashcards on steroids. They supercharge memorization by automatically monitoring your progress and using that information to design a daily customized to-do list of new words to learn and old words to review. Do this now. Learn to use a spaced repetition system, or SRS. We have found a way to defeat forgetting. Now we must decide what to remember. In the next four chapters, I'll show you precisely what to learn and how to learn it. We'll begin with the sounds and alphabet of your language. This will give you the structure you need to remember new words easily. To accomplish this, I'll show you old and new tools that can quickly rewire your ears, and we'll use spaced repetition to rapidly memorize example words for every important letter combination. For example, GN, as in gnocchi. In short order, you will master the sounds of your language. Armed with your language's sounds, you can begin to tackle words. I will show you a list of 625 most frequent concrete nouns, verbs, and adjectives. These words are easy to visualize, which makes them easy to remember. We'll insert them into your SRS with a combination of pictures, personal connections, and sounds. In turn, your SRS will quickly insert those words into your long-term memory. In the process, you'll construct a foundation upon which you can build the rest of your grammar and vocabulary. Finally, I will show you how to use Google Images to find illustrated stories for every word and grammatical concept in your language. You'll use these stories to make effective, memorable flashcards for your SRS. Before long, your grammar will become a reflex, and you won't need to worry about it. Every new word will reinforce that grammatical reflex, and every new piece of grammar will reinforce your words. Your language will build itself to fluency, and you'll come along for the ride. Before we begin, you have a choice to make. There are two main types of SRSs, paper-based and computer-based. Choose your SRS and learn to use it. Then look at your daily schedule and determine how much time you have available. We'll use that information to create a language learning habit. Choose your spaced repetition system. The most popular SRSs are computer-based, and my absolute favorite is Anki. First released in 2008, Anki is free, easy to use, and runs on every operating system and smartphone. It syncs between devices, so you can study at home on your computer and then continue on your smartphone on the train to work, and it can handle images and sound files. You tell it how many new flashcards you want to learn every day, and it handles the rest. In roughly 30 minutes per day, you can learn 30 new cards and maintain all of your old cards. Scale up or down as needed to fit your schedule and tolerance for LCD screens. If you prefer working with your hands, you can create an SRS with physical flashcards. Named after an Austrian science journalist writing in the 1970s, the Leitner box is just a particularly clever way to use a flashcard file box, some dividers, and a calendar. In the original version, your box is divided into four sections. You review section 1 every day, section 2 every 2 days, section 3 every 3 days, and so on. When you successfully remember a card, gatto is a cute picture of a cat, for instance, then it will move into the next section. If you forget, it moves back into section 1. This acts like a gauntlet for words. Any flashcards that can get all the way to the last section have won their way into your long-term memory. The original system uses shorter intervals than we need, 1, 2, 3, and 4 days, as opposed to weeks or months. But we can fix that by adding a few more dividers and changing the schedule around. You'll find detailed instructions and an appropriate schedule for a Leitner box over in Appendix 3, along with download links for Anki. Not sure whether to use a Leitner box? When you use physical flashcards, you benefit from an involved, hands-on arts and crafts experience with each of your cards. This is a wonderful learning experience that will make your cards much easier to remember, and you lose this experience when you move to a computer. Still, computerized SRSs have a number of advantages over physical flashcards, so don't make your decision just yet. First things first, you can't make paper flashcards talk. You'll be learning pronunciation before you learn vocabulary, and it is much easier to learn pronunciation when your flashcards can talk to you. If you use physical flashcards, you'll need to set aside time to listen to recordings of your words, and you'll need to become very comfortable with the phonetic alphabet. This won't take you a long time, but it is work, and now you can't say I didn't warn you ahead of time. Second, it is extraordinarily easy to get pictures from Google Images into computerized flashcards, and pictures are the most effective way to remember large amounts of information. Even if you use physical flashcards, and even if you're a terrible artist, you should be drawing pictures for every word you encounter. Your visual memory is too helpful to ignore, and as long as you can tell your cat stick figure from your dog stick figure, you'll still reap the benefits. Third, the process of finding images for computerized flashcards is one of the most powerful learning experiences you could ever hope for. Again, your brain sucks in images like a sponge. In just a few seconds, browsing through 20 dog images will create a powerful, lasting memory. Even if you're using physical flashcards, don't pass up the opportunity to learn your words through Google Images. We'll cover this process in depth in Chapter 4. Last, you'll be making two cards for many words. A comprehension card, which asks, what does the word bear mean? And a production card, which may have a picture of a bear and ask you what the word for that is. Making duplicate cards on a computer is easy. Doing it by hand can get tedious. And if it's too tedious, skip the production cards. You may get enough of a memory bump from the arts and craftiness of physical flashcards to spare yourself the need for them. And if you're having trouble keeping a word in memory, then you can always make the production card later. Go to Appendix 3 and pick your poison. If you choose to use a Leitner box, then you have some supplies to pick up and a calendar to fill in. If you go for Anki, then download it, install it, and follow the video tutorials until you understand how to use it. Time commitments and your language habit. Take a moment to plan out your budding language habit. You'll have two customizable time commitments, creating your flashcards and reviewing those flashcards. Your flashcard reviews should be regular. Ideally, you're looking for a slot in your schedule that you can maintain on a daily basis. If you can connect your review time to another regularly occurring event in your life, for example, breakfast or your daily commute, you'll have an easier time establishing a new language habit. While daily reviews are best, Any regular routine will naturally adapt to your schedule. If you skip weekends, for example, you'll have more reviews to do on Mondays. But since you're only learning for 5 days a week, you'll have fewer reviews than someone practicing daily. So it will stay manageable. Start with a small number of new cards, 15 to 30 per day. You can always decide later if you want to go crazy with your flashcards. As mentioned earlier, you can learn 30 new cards per day and maintain all your old cards in exchange for 30 minutes a day. If you go overboard with learning new cards, they will come back later, whether you have time for them or not. In the middle of my Russian adventures, I spent a summer learning 60 new cards per day. It took me around an hour a day. After the summer, when I had significantly less time, those cards showed up for months in my daily reviews. I eventually got through them, but if I had begun learning Russian in that way, I may have run away screaming. Learn new cards at a rate that you know you can maintain. Now, do note that we're talking about learning 30 new cards per day, rather than 30 new words. Over the next few chapters, I'm going to show you how to break sounds, words, and grammar into their smallest, easiest-to-remember bits. You'll memorize each bit individually. As a result, some words may involve a small handful of cards. This may sound like more work. I have to memorize 4 flashcards for a single Chinese character. But, as you'll see, it's going to make your life much easier. SRSs give you the ability to retain everything you throw into them. As long as you can review a little bit each day, there's no end to what you can jam into your head. And as long as your cards are simple and easy to remember, you'll be able to learn them quickly and easily. There is one more time commitment, card creation, and it can be much more sporadic than card reviews. I tend to go on card creation binges around once a month, sitting for absurd numbers of hours in front of my computer and making hundreds upon hundreds of cards in a weekend. I get obsessive when I'm having fun. You may prefer a more moderate approach. You'll find that it's a nice way to spend a long Sunday afternoon, and if your schedule demands something more regular, then 20 minutes every day should do the trick. If you miss a day, and you will occasionally, then it's not the end of the world. The only difficulty is that your reviews will pile up whether you want them to or not. Remember, your SRS is just a fancy to-do list. If your SRS believes you're about to forget the word pollo, then that flashcard will land in your to-do list even while you're vacationing in Hawaii. Once you get back from your vacation, you may have a long list waiting for you. At that point, you should complete those reviews first. They'll give you the best payback for your time, and they'll get you back on track with your language habit. Cut back on learning new cards and spend a few days working at your reviews until they're back to normal levels. Once you find a convenient time to review, your routine will transform into a habit on its own. These habits form easily for the same reasons that SRSs work so well. All of those hormones that help you store information, they tend to feel good. As a result, you'll find your hands automatically reaching for your flashcards as soon as you sit down on the train. Let's get you some flashcards so you can get started already. For the intermediates, you're going to be relying upon your SRS just as much as the beginners. Choose your system and get familiar with how it works. Then look at your schedule and figure out where your language studies will fit in. Chapter 3. Sound Play.
L'accent est l'âme du discours. Il lui donne le sentiment et la vérité.
Accent is the soul of language. It gives language its feeling and truth.
Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Émile. We are now the knights who say, Eki, 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 f-keng, zoop, boing, zorn, zorin.
The knights who until recently said, ni. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. We've spent 2 chapters pontificating about learning and memory, and admittedly, we haven't gotten much done. You haven't learned any useful words, and I'm about to tell you not to open your grammar book. Instead, we're going to venture off into the land of sound. We'll discuss many reasons why, but the most important is this. When you're not sure about the way your language sounds, you're stuck learning 2 languages instead of just 1. In an ideal world, the written language and the spoken language walk together, hand in hand. They share words freely among themselves, help each other through tough spots, and generally have a good time together. You come along, hang out, and soon enough, the 3 of you are good buddies. Written language gives you some good book recommendations, you have a dinner over at spoken language's house, and the 3 of you have a blast. What's not to love? The 2 languages have a new companion, and you're getting to know them at breakneck speed, because you can chat about what you've read, and you can read about what you've heard. All of this goes to crap if we don't start with pronunciation, because we get stuck with a bunch of broken words. We encounter a broken word whenever we think a word is pronounced one way, but it's actually pronounced a different way. These words can't be shared between the written language and the spoken language, and as a result, they break up our little circle of friends. You may have encountered broken words in English. I certainly have. I spent the majority of my life convinced that the word scheme was pronounced sheem. I read about color schemes, pyramid schemes, and the scheming con men who ran them. Unfortunately, scheme had a friend named scheme. Scheme seemed quite familiar in meaning and usage to scheme, but I never seemed to see both words in the same place, so I never knew when to use which word. I avoided using either of them whenever possible. I only discovered the true identity of scheme in the middle of college, when I finally decided to Google both words and figure out the real differences between them, and instead discovered that my two words were in fact one word and one pronunciation mistake. My two schemes lived in a crevice. They had hewn between my spoken language and my written language. This crevice was, thankfully, small. I only rarely fell in and became confused, because schemes are not everyday occurrences. But imagine for a moment how difficult it would be if your entire language were dotted with schemes and schemes lurking behind every corner. You would never be sure of the precise meaning and usage of any of these words, and as a result, you'd have a terribly difficult time using or remembering them. In English, you're unlikely to fall into the broken word trap many times. You're surrounded by conversations, books, movies, and television shows that will inevitably catch the wackiest of pronunciation mistakes. In a foreign language, you're not so lucky. At the end of my French immersion program, I sat in a classroom with 7 advanced French students discussing philosophy. We had recently read Huis Clos by Sartre, and we were comparing Sartre's ideas with those of Descartes. It may have been the most esoteric, highbrow conversation I've ever had, and it was in French, of all things. One of my colleagues raised her hand and pointed out that there was another philosopher we should be discussing. His name was Descartes. My colleague had been caught by a broken word, but this time her language was full of them. French is notorious for its quirky spelling. The vast majority of French's final consonants are thrown away. B-E-A-U-X is pronounced beau, and V-O-U-S is pronounced vous. Oddities like these emerge in nearly every language. In English, phrases like I'm going to go are gradually replaced with I'm gonna go, which may eventually turn into I gonna go. These changes occur more quickly in the spoken language than in the written language, so each language eventually splits in half. French is accordingly 2 languages, the written language of D-E-S-C-A-R-T-E-S and the spoken language of Descartes. In the ideal world we discussed earlier, you and these 2 languages will grow together and support each other. When you read a book, new words and bits of grammar find their way into your conversations. In those conversations, you'll hear new words, which will find their way into your writing. Every time you encounter new input, it improves your understanding and fluency in every aspect of your language. This process only works if you can successfully connect the words you read to the words you hear. My colleague had read about Descartes from books. She had heard about Descartes in discussions. Because she hadn't internalized French's drop the final consonants rule, she was struggling to keep track of broken words with similar names, very similar beliefs, and the exact same professions. By the end of our discussion, she had learned about her mistake, but what about the hundreds or thousands of words we hadn't discussed? Which broken deserts, budgets, and terrains, or better said, déserts, budget, and terrain, were still hiding in the shadows, armed with their silent final consonants, and waiting for their opportunity to cause confusion? The better you internalize good pronunciation habits in the beginning, the less time you'll waste hunting down broken words. If you can build a gut instinct about pronunciation, then every new word you read will automatically find its way into your ears and your mouth, and every word you hear will bolster your reading comprehension. You'll understand more, you'll learn faster, and you'll spare yourself the hunt for broken words. Along the way, you'll have an easier time memorizing, you'll make better impressions upon native speakers, and you'll speak more confidently when you're ready. How can you do this quickly? If you spend 2 months poring over spelling rules and vowel charts before learning a single word, you're probably going to get bored. You need a path through pronunciation that quickly teaches you the basics and then reinforces and develops your pronunciation instincts while you're busy learning the rest of your language. In this chapter, I'll break down the 3 main challenges you're up against: ear training, mouth training, and eye training. We'll cover the differences between them, the methods you'll use to beat them, and the rewards you'll find when you do.
Train your ears. Rewire your brain. At the edge of the North Sea, a German Coast Guard officer waits at his radio.
Ksht!
Mayday, mayday! Hello, can you hear us? We are sinking.
Ja, hallo, this is the German Coast Guard.
We are sinking, we are sinking.
Okay, what are you thinking about?
Berlitz advertisement. Babies get a lot of credit in the language learning world. They have a seemingly superhuman ability to hear the differences between every sound in every language, and there are quite a lot of sounds to hear. The world's languages contain roughly 800 phonemes, 600 consonants, and 200 vowels. Most languages choose around 40 of these to form their words, although the range is quite broad. There's a neat language called Rotokas in Papua New Guinea with only 11 phonemes, and Ta, spoken in Botswana, uses up to 112, plus 4 tones. Some of these phonemes are totally foreign to an English speaker's ear. The click languages of Africa can sound bizarre, but most phonemes are subtle variations on familiar sounds. There are at least 10 Ts that occur in the world's languages, and English speakers rarely hear the differences among any of them. 2 different T's allow you to hear the difference between my cat Stan and my cat's tan. But unless you frequent cat tanning salons, this distinction isn't particularly important in English. If, on the other hand, you were learning Korean, you would find that the T as in tan and the T as in Stan are 2 entirely different letters which form entirely different words. You can't easily hear the distinctions between the 10 T's because you've learned to ignore them. Back when you were a baby, you could hear all of them. This made your world a very confusing place. You were surrounded by babbling adults, each of whom had slightly different ways of saying their vowels and consonants. Your ears rang with the sounds of hundreds of different consonants and vowels, and you lay within this chaos, searching for order. You began to find this order between 6 months and 1 year of age. The best data we have on this process come from studies of Americans and the Japanese. By using brain scans, researchers can see whether an individual can hear the difference between any 2 sounds. An American adult listening to a monotonous rock, 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 lock will show a sudden spike in brain activity when lock breaks the monotony. But a Japanese adult won't show any change whatsoever. A Japanese baby, however, has no trouble whatsoever recognizing the 2 sounds, an ability that gradually vanishes between 6 and 12 months of age. What happens at this critical juncture? The baby's brain is collecting statistics. There is a smooth line that connects the letters R and L, and a consonant can fall anywhere on that line. In an American household, a typical baby will hear hundreds of slightly different consonants that tend to fall into 2 large piles along this line. Sounds that are mostly R-like and sounds that are mostly L-like. If you record a typical day in an American baby's life and count up those sounds and graph them, you'll see those 2 piles. We tend to think of R and L as 2 distinct sounds, but they're not. Each consonant is a group of sounds that are roughly similar. We create these groups according to the sound environment in which we're raised. Because we don't hear many sounds halfway in between R and L, we correctly decide that those babbling adults are all using variations of 2 consonants instead of hundreds. A baby in a Japanese household may hear many of the same sounds, but most of those sounds fall directly in the middle of the R-L spectrum. They correctly group all of these sounds together into a consonant halfway in between R and L. This consonant, the Japanese R, doesn't quite sound like R, and it doesn't quite sound like L. If you listen to it, D, you'll find that your English-attuned brain doesn't quite know what to do with it. It will get filtered into one of your 2 consonant groups, almost at random. When you listen to a person with a thick Japanese accent, notice this. They aren't saying R when they mean to say L. They're saying a consonant you can't quite hear. Hearing the unhearable. The magic of minimal pair testing. Let's return to our Japanese adult, listening to a monotonous rock, 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 rock in a brain scanner. As was discussed, he won't show any neural response if we surreptitiously sneak in a lock. What wasn't yet discussed is how terrifying this is for language learning. It's not that he misinterprets what he hears. He literally cannot hear the difference between these 2 sounds. As far as his brain is concerned, the words rock and lock might as well be spelled the same.
In learning English, he's fighting his own brain. How can he possibly hope to succeed? The most promising research in this field comes from a collection of studies performed at Stanford and Carnegie Mellon. Researchers took a group of Japanese adults, gave them a small wad of cash, headphones, and a computer, and told them to sit in a room and listen to recordings of the words rock and lock. Their job is to press a button labeled rock when they heard rock, and to press a button labeled lock when they heard lock. Understandably, their performance was terrible. Even after practicing, it remained terrible. So far, so bad. Now here comes the magic. Another group of participants was placed in the same situation, only this time, their computer screens provided immediate feedback after each button press. For every correct guess, they saw a green check mark. For every incorrect guess, they saw a red X. And suddenly, they began to learn. After 3 20-minute sessions, they had successfully rewired their brains. On later brain scans, they showed a marked response in the rock, 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 lock tests. They had learned to hear the unhearable. We can take this research and use it for our own needs. Rock and lock are classic members of a special group of words known as minimal pairs. These are pairs of words that differ by only one sound, and every language is full of them. I have tortured quite a few of my Austrian English students on the differences between minimal pairs like thinking and sinking, suspect and suspect, and niece and knees. These pairs get right to the heart of the hearing problem in a language, and practicing them with feedback provides the best way to train our ears and rewire our brains. You'll be able to find the essential minimal pairs in your language at the beginning of many grammar books with CDs, and definitely throughout all pronunciation books. And I'm making it a personal mission to provide minimal pair tests on my website in as many languages as I can find. fluent-forever.com/chapter-3. These tests are as basic as they get. They play a recording, lock, and then ask you what word you heard, rock or lock. But what they lack in panache, they make up for in results. I used them to learn the obnoxiously difficult sounds of Hungarian in 20 minutes a day for 10 days. They're also a lot of fun. You can feel your ears changing with every repetition. The benefits of ear training: pattern recognition and pattern breaking. When you use minimal pair testing at the beginning of your language journey, you'll learn much faster in the long run. You'll have an easier time remembering new words because they no longer sound foreign. You'll also understand native speakers better because your ears are in sync with their speech. Instead of wasting your time correcting bad pronunciation habits, you'll be able to spend your time consuming language at breakneck speed. How does ear training cause all of this to happen? You've given yourself the ability to recognize individual sounds, but that's not the end of the story. Because you've spent time focusing on those sounds, you'll be aware of the subtle changes that occur when you string those sounds together. This gives you two superpowers. You can hear sound rules, and you can hear when those rules are broken. Sound rules connect spelling to sound and sound to sound. They tell you which sounds can be combined. Sticks, for instance, is okay in English, and which can't. Svix is not. Languages are full of complex sound rules, and we're very good at picking them up if we can hear them. You can observe this with kids. There's a neat linguistic test that researchers like to perform on 5-year-olds. They show them a weird bird drawing, and they proclaim, "This is a wug." Then they show the kids 2 of them. "Now there are 2 of them. These are 2." And the kids gleefully exclaim, "Wugs!" This all seems simple and pleasant enough, but keep in mind that these kids are performing an extraordinarily complex operation. Somehow, deep within their cute little heads, they know that the plural of this entirely new word sounds like zzz, whereas the plural of a different new word, like heath, sounds like s, and the plural of tass sounds like is. These rules are nothing to sniff at, and they're different in every language. German kids say wax, not wugs. If your ears are sensitive to each new sound in your language, you will notice when there's a strange sound rule afoot, and every time you notice it, you'll get closer to internalizing it. Your second superpower allows you to notice when words break those rules. In English, we have lots of pronunciation rules. A K is always pronounced like k, as in kick, except when it's not, as in knife. The nice thing about rules and exceptions is that even when they're as maddeningly complex as English, and lucky for you, they are nearly always simpler in other languages, they never create new sounds. There is no word in English that doesn't reuse one of the 41 or 42 sounds of the English language, and this is the case in every language. If you can hear all the sounds in your language, then you might get surprised by the spelling of a word, but never by the sound of a word. This helps you learn faster because your memory doesn't need to struggle to store some indescribable new sound. If a word like mjöðr is just a combination of six familiar sounds, then it's no longer particularly foreign, and it won't be any harder to remember than an unusual but understandable name like Lakira. Because of this, you'll be able to memorize the pronunciation of new words accurately, which will allow you to recognize them when they're spoken by a native speaker. Poof, you've just given your listening comprehension a massive boost from the start. If you have better listening comprehension, you'll gain more vocabulary and grammar every time you hear someone speak your language. Poof, you've just boosted your vocabulary and grammar knowledge for the rest of your life. You gain all this at the expense of a few hours of minimal pair study. Now, if we can learn to produce those sounds, we're in business. Key points. 1. Your brain is hardwired to ignore the differences between foreign sounds. To rewire it, listen to minimal pairs in your target language, similar sounding words like niece and knees, and test yourself until your brain adapts to hear these new sounds. 2. By practicing in this way, you'll be better equipped to recognize words when they're spoken, and you'll have an easier time memorizing them on your own. Train your mouth. Get the girl. Nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Theodore Roosevelt. I was recently asked the following. If I had 4 hours to prepare for a date with a Cambodian supermodel, what would be the best use of my time? Here's my answer. Learn to say one phrase, any phrase, really well. Sit on YouTube or Wikipedia for a few hours, look at pictures of mouth positions, and mimic recordings until you can sound like a native speaker for 3 seconds. It will blow her mind. An accurate accent is powerful because it is the ultimate gesture of empathy. It connects you to another person's culture in a way that words never can, because you have bent your body as well as your mind to match that person's culture. Anyone can learn bonjour in a few seconds. To learn how bonjour fits into your companion's mouth and tongue, to learn how to manipulate the muscles, the folds, and even the texture of your throat and lips to match your companion's, this is an unmistakable, undeniable, and irresistible gesture of care. To be fair, a good accent can occasionally get you in a bit of trouble. A few years ago, I went to Japan and learned a few simple Japanese phrases. I remember walking up to a lady and asking where to find the nearest department store. Her eyes opened wide, surprised by the tall, lanky white guy addressing her with a half-decent Japanese accent. Then she exploded into a rapid-fire paragraph-long answer to my question. I winced, put up my hands, and blabbered something in Japanese on the order of, "Japanese, I, no, a little, is." She stopped, laughed a bit, and pointed to the left. All in all, I think developing a good accent is worth the effort, even if it makes people think you know more than you do. The alternative, a thick, non-native accent, will get you in much more trouble. Paris has a particularly bad reputation on this front. As rumor has it, a momentary bonjour will spoil your meal in any restaurant. But you will see this everywhere. People with strong foreign accents are frequently treated as less adept at the language and less intelligent as a person than they are. And even if this is unfair, it is understandable. It's uncomfortable to speak with someone when you aren't sure what they're saying or whether they understand you. To try to relieve this discomfort, you may start speaking louder, using simpler words, switching to their language if you can, or avoiding the person altogether. My father inexplicably develops an exaggerated Spanish accent whenever he orders Chinese food. "I like a chicken fried rice, oh, please, oh." We all go a little nuts when we don't feel understood. This phenomenon can screw up your language learning. You currently speak the most common language on earth. If you're trying to speak French and French people prefer to speak to you in English, you won't get the language exposure you need. Train your mouth. Let's figure out how to develop a good accent. I frequently heard that it's impossible to perfect an accent after the age of 12. But this can't be true. Actors and singers do it all the time, and we're not any smarter or better than the rest of humanity. We just care about pronunciation. We have to. No one will pay us for bad German. So we take the time to do it right. We start early, and we gain an awareness of what's going on in our mouths when we speak. Half of a good accent is simply a matter of timing. Singers learn pronunciation first, and as a result, we don't have to fight years of bad habits. We learn to parrot words accurately before we have any idea what they mean, so that we can get on a stage without embarrassing ourselves. You should do the same. If you wait until later to work on your accent, you will have butchered every word in your vocabulary hundreds or thousands of times. This is where myths like the 12-year-old cap on accent learning come from. It's hard to unlearn bad habits. If, instead, you work on your accent early, then you will tend to pronounce all of your new words correctly. With every new word you learn, you'll reinforce good pronunciation habits, and those habits will last you a lifetime. If you've already studied a language, you may have some deeply ingrained bad habits. Your road will be longer, but there's hope for you yet. First, the bad news. Your old habits are not going to vanish. They're carved permanently into some crevice of your brain. We'll build new habits in the crevice next door. Once you've trained your ears and mouth to produce the sounds of your language correctly, your job will be to learn each new word with your fancy new accent. Eventually, you will find two voices in your head, an old crummy one and a new awesome one. As you consistently and consciously choose to use your new voice for new words, you'll strengthen your good habits until they become more familiar and comfortable than your bad habits. A few bonjours may slip through occasionally, but overall, you'll have the snazzy accent that gets you that Cambodian supermodel you were clamoring after. So, how do you learn to pronounce new sounds? What do the actors and singers know that everyone else doesn't? It's not all that complex. We simply know that the sounds we make are created by the movements of muscles in our mouths. We pick up an awareness of the everyday movements of our tongues and lips, and we combine them in a few new ways. For instance, when you say ooh, as in boo, your lips form a circle. If you keep your lips in that same circle, when you try to say e as in see, you'll make a funny sound. E-u. This is a new vowel, which you'll find at the end of French words like fondue. If you practice it a little, you'll be able to act like a pretentious jerk at parties. Oh, sorry, what did you eat? A fondue? Oh, perhaps you meant a fondue. Oh, now I understand. To master your own mouth, you'll need information. You need to know what your mouth is actually doing whenever you open it. This information can be hard to access because it's hidden in relatively impenetrable linguistic jargon. Terms like voiceless epiglottal fricative aren't particularly inspiring. And so most people are forced to rely upon terrible, confusing descriptions. Oh, it's kind of like, you know, like when a Scottish person says loch, but only it's further back in the throat. Kind of like gargling, only deeper. I've made a series of YouTube videos to help you get the pronunciation information you need. fluent-forever.com/chapter-3. Watch them. They take 35 minutes, and at the end, you'll understand how your mouth does what it does. In those videos, I go over a tremendously valuable tool known as the International Phonetic Alphabet, or IPA. It was created, naturally, by the French, who needed some way to deal with the fact that four of the five letters in H-A-I-E-S, or hedges, were silent. That word is pronounced eh. The phonetic alphabet they developed does two awesome things. It turns languages into easily readable sounds, and it tells you exactly how to make each of those sounds. In English, there are 10 ways to spell the oo sound in the word two. In IPA, there is only one. Always. The letter U. Every IPA letter is not only a sound, but also a set of instructions on how to make that sound. This is super useful. When I began Hungarian, I looked up the sounds of that language on Wikipedia. Hungarian has a few odd sounds, including g, which is basically our j as in jar if you keep the front of your tongue touching your bottom teeth. G. I've never spoken to a Hungarian about this, and no one has ever told me to put my tongue in that weird position. The IPA symbols themselves spell it out for me, and they can do it for you too. There are two barriers in the way. The IPA is usually full of nasty technical jargon, and it uses weird-looking symbols. I can't get rid of the symbols. English uses 26 letters for 42 sounds. A phonetic alphabet needs extra symbols. but I can show you a way around the jargon. In general, you only need three pieces of information to make any sound. You need to know what to do with your tongue, with your lips, and with your vocal cords. And there aren't that many options. Your vocal cords go on and off. That's it. It's the only difference between s and z. When you're speaking vowels, your lips are basically rounded like oo or not. That's all.